Greetings to everyone, as we have all come here to keep the Sabbath day, which God has made holy. We are to keep it holy. That's a big word. There's a big distinction there, because, and many people don't recognize the meaning of that word is God has made it holy. You keep it holy. Your job and my job are to keep it holy. And how do we do that? In it you shall not do any work. That's what the commandment says. That's, you know, that's the beginning parts, at least, of how we keep it holy. Well, anyway, welcome to everyone. If you're here in personal attendance, or if you may be watching online, welcome to everyone for God's holy Sabbath day. Today, the title of the sermon is The Face of the Ox. Now, that's not really exactly biblically accurate either, because in the book of Revelation, and I believe it's chapter 4 and verse 7 and 8, these four creatures are described surrounding the throne. The lion, the ox, the man, and the eagle. So you got those four creatures surrounding the throne. And each one of those creatures represents something. And so the sermon is called The Face of the Ox, but it's really not just the face, but the whole creature that's there surrounding the throne. I'd like to begin here by giving you citations, because I'm admonished by the people in Cincinnati who are charged with being sure that we give credit to those people who have done intellectual property work. This book by Andrew Jukes, originally by Andrew Jukes, it has been remastered, you know, like the movies, digitally remastered. Well, it's been remastered. It was written in 1853, and that's a remarkable thing for the information that's in here. 1853. And it was, I don't know if it was copyrighted at the time. I sort of don't think that the copyright laws were anything like they are today, if there even were copyright laws. But anyway, Andrew Jukes wrote this book. It was edited and reprinted in 1966. Now that's more than 100 years after he wrote it. And this little pamphlet, almost, you think, had pretty much been forgotten about and buried in the dustbin of history. But lo and behold, Kriegel Press hired a person to edit it, completely rewrite it, because a lot of the phrases and vocabulary that were contained in it had been left in the dustbin of history. Old English. And in order to get it into a modern kind of English that could be understood, they hired an editor to completely reconstitute the book. And I would say it's been well worth it. It was done in 1966, and it's been printed a number of times since then. And so Kriegel Publications in Grand Rapids, Michigan, has a lot of credit to be given for this book, because I feel the book is very valuable. I am not saying that this book is the Bible. There are, I'm confident, mistakes in the book, and it's not perfect. But for the information that's provided, if you'd like to get a copy and read it, it's not easy reading. It's kind of heavy reading, and if I read 5 pages and tried to digest those 5 pages in a day's time, that was a pretty good assignment. Pretty good assignment. And I'm continuing to do that. Next week I will be doing it some more, since I'll be working on the face of the man, Book of Luke. But each the indication that Jukes had, and he has traced this back to the time in which the Bible was written, he writes that these four creatures surrounding the throne are not really creatures, although he feels that they are, in some way, maybe perhaps really creatures around the throne, but he looks at them as being symbolic, each one of them, of one of the Gospels. Matthew being symbolic of the book of Matthew, or the lion. The lion being the symbol of rulership, and Matthew having been written as being about Christ as the King of the Jews. Mark being related to the ox, and Christ as the great servant of the Bible. Now, in those days, the days of the Bible, there were no tractors. And for the younger people here, there were no computers or television either. And so they didn't relate. But, you know, today we have these tractors that actually they began in Texas cutting wheat at the time that the wheat is ripe, and the wheat gradually gets riper up the midsection of the country until you get to the border of Canada. So there are these tractor companies that come and combine and thresh the wheat. And that's kind of like, okay, this is a big ox doing the work in the fields that need to be done. Here Christ is pictured pretty much in the same way. You know, these four beasts, according to what Jukes feels to be true, are the four Gospels. And they believed that, according to him, they believed in the early church that these four books were representative of the four Gospels. And it sure does make a lot of sense to me when I read it, that I look at the things that separate these Gospels. Why would we have four Gospels? Couldn't we have said it all in one book? Could have. God could have chosen to do that. But he actually put it into four different books. And we would surmise the reason for four different books surrounding the throne of Christ is so that Christ could be portrayed in four different ways. Once as a king, once as a servant, once as a human being, and the fourth one as God. Christ being portrayed in those different ways. I'm going to read to you something here from page 16 of this book. The early church, now just what did the early church see? I'm fixing to read to you. The early church saw this. Saw what is this? What is this? What did the early church see? He's saying the early church saw these four creatures around the throne as being representative of the four different gospels, each one having a different approach to the ministry of Christ and reporting on it in a different way. The early church saw this. And with one voice they testify as to what they saw, namely that the four Gospels contained four different aspects of the great manifestation. He put great manifestation in caps, that is to say, the life of Christ. The great manifestation is the life of Christ. And though they say that the fathers, and though to say the fathers so viewed the matter, you know, fathers being who? Well, the early church leaders, he's saying that the early church leaders viewed it this way, may not be a really good recommendation. May not in these days, and he's 1860. So if it didn't commend it in 1860, what about today? You know, today it would be a lot less likely to be received by the general society around us. So what? The early church believed that? Ha! They were not very smart at all. So I don't really put much stock in the fact that they believed it. Well, we do, don't we? We do. Though to say the fathers so viewed the matter may not in these days commend the view, it will at least prove that the doctrine here is no novelty. If he can show evidence that the original church so viewed it as being four different gospel accounts, it would at least prove that he had made up some new doctrine, that it had been something that was handed down through the generations going all the way back to the early church. The emblem which applied to the Gospels was that of the four cherubim, or living creatures, conceiving that these four living creatures were apt representation of the four evangelists, or Gospels, or more correctly, to express their thought of these manifestations of Christ himself, which the four Gospels respectively present to us. Christ himself being one and the same in each, yet seen and set forth by each in a different way. You know? So that's what the early church believed about these things, according to Andrew Jukes. And now this book, which has been reprinted from 1966, that kind of makes it an old book, doesn't it? Here's a principle I think we need to put in our pipe and smoke. Let's say it that way. You got something, put it in your pipe and smoke it. I don't know, you might think that had to do with marijuana, but I think it predates the wide use of marijuana. So we used to say that when I was maybe Ani's age growing up, and you put that in your pipe and smoke it. It was you were to get a flavor out of your pipe, I guess. People were smoking tobacco then, which wasn't good either. But here's a point I'd like for you to think about in relationship to this sermon, and to all of these sermons, really. To find hidden meaning. That's what we're talking about here, isn't it? These four Gospels have hidden information in them that we would not have noticed. I would not have noticed. Maybe you would have. I'm not going to necessarily charge you with all my weaknesses, but I wouldn't have recognized the fact that it was there unless I knew what I was looking for. You know? And I thought about that in relationship to our garden. We got back from Estonia, and the weeds, we left some people there in charge of the garden, but they were only really to pick it and water it. And apparently they kept it picked and watered, and they must have fertilized the weeds as well, because the weeds were taller than we were. We were gone for 4 weeks, and that's what happened in the garden. And so we called Sheldon, who's a helper that we use around the house, to come and look at the garden and till it. So he comes up. We have an ox. We have an ox. We have a blue ox. It is a Ford tractor. And it does a lot of work. You know, you can do a certain amount of work by hand. But anybody who was going to pull the weeds in that garden, which is about 60 feet long and 60 feet wide, was going to have a lot of pulling to do. So Sheldon cranked up the tractor, put the tiller on it, and went through that garden in an hour. You know, that's pretty good. That tractor is a pretty good symbol of an ox, able to do the work. However, before we left home, we had planted a whole new crop of lettuce. So by the time we came back, we would have fresh lettuce for the rest of the summer. When Sheldon went out to plow or till the garden, he didn't know that lettuce had been planted among the weeds. And so he tilled it all under. Sheldon did not know what he was looking for. And if we're reading the Bible, and we have four Gospels here that are written from a different point of view, and we don't know when we read it what it is that we're looking for, if we don't realize the book of Matthew is written from the point of view that Christ was born to be a king, we probably miss that. We read it. We read right over it. Now we'll start the book of Matthew, and we'll look at all of those genealogical names that are two or three pages long, from Abraham all the way to Christ, and we won't see that he's saying that Christ was a descendant of Abraham. That's the reason he went to Abraham and stopped. If we weren't looking for that, if we don't know what we're looking for, we won't find it. If we don't know that Mark wrote his gospel from the point of view of Christ as a servant, we'll look all the way through that. We'll read all the way through it and maybe think, as the world does, Mark kind of didn't do a very good job of writing this gospel because he wrote it in a rather less than studious way. But he wrote it from the point of view of being a servant. So if we're, this is the principle I'm trying to point out to you. As you read these Gospels, you need to read them comparatively. One Gospel as opposed to another Gospel, and see that Matthew is presenting Christ as the King of the Jews, uniquely in that way. So he won't have his account necessarily as Mark had his account, or as Luke had his account, or as John had his account. They had different aspects of Christ that they were portraying. And if you know that, and if you're looking for it, you can find it. But you have to know that, which I, without this book, I wouldn't have known it. I wouldn't have figured that out for myself. Sheldon didn't know about the lettuce, hence he tilled it up. And if I don't know about the Gospels, I'm probably going to treat the Gospels in the same way that Sheldon treated the lettuce. Today in this sermon, I want to show you how the Gospel of Mark uniquely presents Christ as the great ox, serving, sacrificing, and doing the work of God. I really didn't get into sacrificing. I mean, I didn't have enough time to put all of this kind of stuff that I put in my SPS into the sermon, or you wouldn't go home today. But I want to show you how the Gospel of Mark presents Christ as the great ox, sacrificing and doing the work of God. Mark was a servant. He worked all of his life as a servant. Here is a principle to notice in regard to the four Gospels. Each Gospel writer was specifically prepared in his life through what he was doing to be able to write his Gospel account. If Christ is being portrayed as a servant in Mark's Gospel, which he's portrayed as a servant in that Gospel, what would be the best thing for Mark to be if he's going to be the one who authors that book? A servant himself, right? He'll understand those acts of service, and he will be able to interpret them and present them as a servant sees a servant. And so with all of the other Gospel writers. I'm not going to go into that now, but each one of the Gospel writers, this is an important point to note. Each one of the Gospel writers was prepared to write his account by the profession in which he lived. You see, Mark was, you can say, well, Mark, he was, well, Mark wasn't one of the original 12, was he? A lot of us probably don't even realize that Mark wasn't one of the 12 original apostles. One of the Gospels carries his name. Surely he must have been one of those people who were the original 12. No. No, he wasn't. No. Now look at Mark from this point of view. Why wouldn't he be one of those 12? Well, the 12 were not servants, were they? Not in the same way. Mark was prepared as a servant to, and it would have been rather inappropriate to make him a servant and one of the 12 apostles. So he's not one of the 12 apostles. Some interesting information from the Gospels about Mark. Acts chapter 12 and verse 12. You see here, Mark was acting as a servant. Whenever Peter, and I think some others as well, were put in prison, and the angel appeared to them in prison, unlocked the door and let them out. Acts chapter 12, verse 12. When he had considered the thing, this is he as Peter, had considered the thing. Now, Peter was there in jail. He didn't know that he was going to be allowed out of jail or the door was going to be unlocked by the angel and he was going to be able to come out. It was a miracle. And nobody had come and informed Peter of the fact that this was going to happen before it happened. But he was let out of the prison. And when he had considered, he said, "What's going on here? I don't know what's going on." The thing, what's he doing? Wandering around the streets of Jerusalem? I mean, the angel let him out, and there he goes. He walks out of the jail, and what does he do now? What now? He didn't know that the people were at Mark's house praying for him. He considered the thing. He's wandering down one of the streets, probably a familiar street to him, because he knew Mark well. He came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark. So you'll see him referred to in the Gospels here, sometimes as Mark and sometimes as John Mark, to distinguish him from others who might be named the same, whose surname was Mark, where many were gathered together praying. He was serving them there. He was a servant. He was chosen, Acts 12, verse 25, not too far down in the book of Mark, or book of Acts, not too far down, another 12 verses. Barnabas and Paul were going out on a missionary journey. And Barnabas wanted to carry Mark. Paul didn't want to take him because he thought he was going to be not very helpful. In fact, was going to probably slow him down. Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had fulfilled their ministry and took with them John. So Paul and Barnabas split up at that point. Mark went with Barnabas, not with Paul. When they had fulfilled their ministry and took with them John, whose surname was Mark. And the contention, Acts 15, verse 39, it says, "The contention was so sharp between them, they departed asunder one from another. Barnabas took Mark and sailed unto Cyprus." Later on, Paul came to regret that. 2 Timothy 4, verse 11. One of the last prison epistles of Paul. He writes to Timothy there, only Luke is with me. Everybody else had abandoned him. He was in prison. They had all abandoned him. Take Mark and bring him with you. He's telling Timothy, you come here and help me, but bring Mark with you. He is helpful and profitable to me for the ministry. Peter as well writes about Mark being helpful. So all of these things you can take and put together and look at Mark as being a servant. Much increase is by the strength of the ox. And we've seen that as well in the tractor in the garden and getting rid of those weeds, and in the asparagus bed getting rid of those weeds. And the ox was then understood as being the great symbol of work being accomplished. The universal symbol too. And I'll just point this out. There was a book written by Pearl Buck, I believe about 1930. Pearl Buck was a missionary to China. And she wrote a book called The Good Earth. And there's a movie about it. It's an old movie, a moldy, oldy, not color at all, black and white movie, but it really gives you a lot to look at and to think about as members of God's church and people who are called to ultimately bring all of mankind into the family of God. You need maybe a perspective on how those people lived. So if you're looking for an entertaining, glitzy movie, don't get it. But if you want something that's going to educate you and help you to serve in God's work in the future, it would be worth looking at. The reason I bring it up in the context of this sermon is the fact that she takes a family and moves them through in her novel, her writing. She moves them through the different stages of life in the Chinese society. And in one of the earliest stages, she presents them as being peasant farmers. Peasant farmers. And as peasant farmers, they had an ox. And the ox was what allowed them to be able to, you know, do all of the things and survive. Time came when they had a famine. The ox lived in the house with them. That's how important he was and how much a part of the family he was considered to be. And they walk around and talk to him and feed him and so on, like a household pet, like you might your dog or cat. This huge creature was in the house with them. Probably just a one room house. But the ox was that important. The ox was that important. Why? Because he plowed the field. He cut the grain. He trampled the grain underfoot and threshed it and did all of those things from the planting in the spring to the harvest and the putting of the grain into storage at the end of the year. It was that important. So I just bring that out because the ox is when you see the throne room of God and you see these four creatures, and the second one mentioned is the ox, Christ is being presented as being like this ox, accomplishing the work of God in the same degree as the physical ox did for everybody in the field. There were no tractors yet. So that's the way it had to be done. I'd like to give you another principle here. What distinguishes one gospel from another gospel? If we're saying this one is presenting Christ as a king, this one is presenting Christ as a servant, the third one is presenting Christ as a human being, and the fourth one is presenting Christ as God. Those four different pictures of the ministry of Christ. You might say the personality and character of Christ being presented in four different ways. How can they do that? If they all presented the same picture of Christ, how would one be differentiated from the other? Would be able to do it? And here's a question. Question for you to contemplate. You can chew on this one. We said before you could put it in your pipe and smoke it. Here you can chew on this one. Is it inconsistent for Christ to be a king and a servant at the same time? What about as a human being and God at the same time? Are these inconsistent? Is it possible that Christ in one picture could have been presented as a king and in another picture as a servant? Was it possible that he could be both at the same time? Could he be a king and a servant at the same time? Could a king be a servant? King could be, of course. Of course. A few were, but not too many. Mostly they were lords, not servants. But one kind of personality being presented selectively in one gospel is possible while he's being portrayed differently in another gospel at the same time. We know that the Bible never contradicts itself. 2 Timothy 3:16 says all scripture is given by inspiration of God. But does it contradict? I mean, the closest I would think we come to saying it's a contradiction is a human being and God. You know, that would be the distinction between Luke and John. If we say Luke pictures Christ as a human being. Was he a human being? Yeah, he was a human being. And was he God? John's very clear about that, isn't it? In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. All things were created by him, and without him was not anything made which was made. But they don't contradict each other. He's capable of doing both at the same time and being presented in a narrative at the same time doing those. Well, how can the gospel writers do that? How can one gospel writer take his series of events that he saw and present it as a picture which shows Christ as a king, while another gospel writer takes similar events, some of them the same events, and present Christ as a servant? Answer to that question goes back to what Dr. Dunkel had to say. Dr. Dunkel, our Winter Family Weekend, said the challenge of writing history is really selecting what to include and what to exclude. If you're going to write an account of history, it's going to reflect what you believe to be true and the picture that you want to present. Now, in the case of the gospel writers, they're going to select from among the things that Christ did and include them in a particular way. And those things will speak of themselves to what they're trying to say. Put more simply, it would be specific omissions. You're going to leave something out. You don't have to report on it. If you're trying to present Christ as a servant, you can leave certain things out and just present certain things that show that he was acting as a servant at that time. As a king, can you find things that would present Christ as a king? Is that true in the book of Matthew? We'll be able to find lots of examples. And here's something I should have said earlier in the sermon, but here it is now anyway. There's a lot of things that we cannot report on in these sermons. If you want to really begin to understand these things, you've got to read and study and contemplate them, meditate on them for yourself, knowing what you know. The lettuce is down there. Don't run over it. You look at each gospel from the point of view. Matthew is presenting Christ as the King of the Jews. Mark is presenting him as the great ox. We'll get to Luke and to John later on. And they can do that by including certain things and excluding other things, or taking the same event and just reporting a different part of that event. Things that are left out, things that were included in the book of Matthew but are left out of the book of Mark. And when you think about it, these are enormous things. Sermon on the Mount. Sermon on the Mount. Would you say there's any more important information in the Bible or in the Gospels than the Sermon on the Mount? Christ reports, Christ is pictured there as the king in his court. His disciples come to him and he explains all kinds of things to them for about 3 or 4 chapters in the book of Matthew, MIA. You remember from the Vietnam War? Korean War, probably the same initials were used missing in action, M-I-A. The account of the Sermon on the Mount is M-I-A in the book of Mark. What could be more important information? Why would Matthew include that and make it of seminal importance while Mark doesn't even mention it? And by the way, which one was written first? You say, well, Mark was the first gospel written. And in the last several days, heard different accounts of exactly when Mark was written. Jukes writes that it was written in 70 A.D. Now, Hazel has some accounts that go back into like 40, 50 A.D., Hazel? 42? She says 42. So we don't have a real hard and fast date. But we know that Mark was written first. And Mark didn't have the advantage of looking at Matthew and saying, oh, well, I don't have to include this because Matthew included it. Matthew had the advantage of looking at what Mark had done, but Mark didn't have the advantage of looking at what Matthew had done, or Luke or John. And so, Sermon on the Mount, missing in action. What about the Olivet Prophecy, Matthew 24 and 25? 25 is really a relevant part of what is missing from the book of Mark. Now, in the book of Mark, it does have a segment of the Olivet Prophecy. But you come to the point of Matthew 25. What's Matthew 25 consists of? Matthew 25 consists of three parables. First one is wise and foolish virgins. The second one is the parable of the talents. And the third one is the parable of the sheep and goats. Those are the three parables which are, it is consistent in the book of Matthew. Matthew 24 is not on a different occasion than Matthew 25. I used to think that. I used to think that they sat up on the Mount of Olives. Christ gave this prophecy about the Mount of Olives. And then maybe there's a break and some time goes by, and then the three parables of Matthew 25 were told. No, it is continuous from the beginning of Matthew 24 all the way through Matthew 25. The chapter break is artificial. And it's very clear that it is. So, why would those three parables be included in Matthew but not in Mark? Again, aren't they some of the most important information? Maybe, just maybe, it's because Matthew was presenting Christ as a king. Those three parables present him as a king. The bridegroom going and coming, returning and receiving and being received by the church. The parable of the talents as a ruler giving calling his servants together, giving them certain responsibilities over monetary things, and being told, go and invest those things and come back. When I come, you'll be required to give account of them. Now, that's the attitude the king would have, isn't it? What about the sheep and the goats? All nations, it says, would be gathered in front of him, the sheep on the right hand, the goats on the left hand, and he's going to pronounce judgment on them. Would that fit into an account of Christ as a servant? That's not the way a servant conducts himself, is it? It's the way a king conducts himself. And you won't find those. You won't find those things in the book of Mark. Some things were added that were not in the other Gospels. And one of them we talked about in the sermonette, the touch of Christ's hand on the people that he was healing. Attitude of a servant serving, concerned with how what he's doing is being received by the people that he's doing it for. You see, and he shares in Mark, he shares information as a servant with those people whom he is serving. He doesn't keep that information separate. From them, apart from them. Let's just read John 15:15. Gives us a principle there. He says, from now on, I don't call you servants. Well, they were servants of God the Father and Christ, but he says, from this point on, I don't call you servants. And you can infer from that he is telling them that he is a servant. I don't call you servants. The servant does not know what his Lord does. But I've called you friends. When it comes to this kind of dividing line, and he says, I called you friends. Won't find this in the other Gospels. I've called you friends, for all things that I have heard of my Father, I have made known to you. You'll find in the book of Mark, and I can't go into too much of it there now, you'll find a demeanor being described. Looks. He looks on somebody in a particular way, and an attitude of tenderness, which is unique to this gospel. Mark 1 and verse 41, it says an example of this. A man came to him and said, if you would, I could be clean. And Christ said, moved with compassion. You know, it doesn't relate that kind of emotional reflection in the other Gospels. But here in Mark, the Gospel that was particularly inclined to present Christ as a servant, it says he was moved with compassion, put forth his hand. touched him and said to him, I will be you clean. Kind of interesting. He called, verse 43, unto him his disciples and said to them. Now he's gone into the temple. This is same day, two verses later. I believe it's two verses later. Yeah, two verses later. And there was a widow there. And you know the story of the widow's mite? All of the rich people were coming and giving big donations in the temple. They were the politicians or the lobbyists of the day. They wanted recognition. And here comes this old lady who lived alone, had almost no income, comes up to the temple, and she has two mites. Now, I don't know what a mite is. I knew at one time, I believe. But very little bit of money. Not much at all. And she gave her two mites into the treasury at the temple. Now, here Christ doesn't make some... He behaves as a servant watching someone else who is serving. He's not commanding or behaving in any other way here, but he called unto him his disciples, and he said to them, truly I say unto you, this poor widow has cast in more than all they which have cast into this treasury. Why? Why? Why did he say that? All they did cast in of their abundance, but she of her want and did cast in all that she had, even all of her living. Christ is presented as one who appreciates true, deep-hearted servant, attitude of servants. I'm going to truncate this. I don't have enough time to give the conclusion, but I think you understand the conclusion already.